degree of review, here's the third stanza, what Paul wrote in his initial epistle. This is Galatians 1:13, 14, 15, and 16. For because indeed you heard of my wayward behavior in some point and place in the practice of Judaism, namely, that because throughout showing superiority, surpassing any measure of restraint to an extraordinary degree and better than anyone else, I was aggressively and intensely pursuing, hastily striving forward, persecuting, oppressing, and harassing the called out of God. And I was, and I am, devastating her, continuing to undermine, overthrow, and annihilate her. And so I was, and I continue to progress, accomplishing a great deal. I persist moving forward in the practice of Judaism, over and beyond many contemporaries among my race, excessively and to an overabundant enthusiasm, zealous and excited, devoted and burning with passion, vehemently adherent to belong to the traditions and teachings handed down by my forefathers. But at a point in time when it pleased and was chosen enjoyable and better for God, the one having appointed me, setting me aside in the womb of my mother to reveal and disclose, uncovering and unveiling the Son of him, in order that I could announce the healing message and beneficial messenger among the races, immediately I did not ask the advice of or consult with flesh and blood. So here's Paul saying that, oh boy, I was super religious. And then he says that my religion, which was Judaism, caused me to be murderous. And as a matter of fact, Judaism is actually at war with the call out of God. Now, of course, every bit of that is a lie. Now, whether or not he was a devout rabbinical Jew, that's up for question. I think no. But his style, his attitude certainly depict rabbinical Judaism. But rabbinical Judaism is a passive religion. It's Judaism is only aggressive towards non-compliant, non-religious Jews. It goes out of its way to harass Jews who do not capitulate. But it does not go out of its way to attack or to criticize any other religion or any other political undertaking. It's an extremely passive religious perspective. And so Paul announcing that it was Judaism that caused him to be murderous is a complete lie. Paul was murderous because of Paul. He had character flaws. He was a demented and savage individual, perverted sexually and savage from a brutality perspective. Then he says, okay, well, that's what Judaism made me do, made me hunt out and harass and annihilate the called out of God. I was a murderer because of Judaism, and I just continued to be Jewish. I just continued to accomplish great things as a religious Jew. I was superlative. I was much better at this Judaism thing than other Jews. And just so that you know, Judaism is adhering to the traditions and teachings handed down by the forefathers. He didn't say that he was engaged in Judaism by being Torah observant. It's amazing that Paul would make this distinction to describe Judaism as being an adherent to the traditions and teachings handed down by the forefathers. And yet, in Christianity, Judaism is associated with being Torah observant and observing what they would consider to be the Jewish holidays of Passover and unleavened bread and the Day of Atonement. That's what they would view. And yet Paul makes this distinction and says, no, that's not Judaism. Judaism is the traditions of the forefathers. That means that Judaism is the Talmud. Judaism is the Mishnah. Judaism is the oral law. Judaism has very little, if anything, to do with the Torah. Now, Paul's depiction of Judaism as a whole engendering rage and murder is invalid. But his depiction of Judaism being the traditions of the forefathers is absolutely accurate, a distinction that Christians seem unable to make. Then he says that while he was being super religious, that it pleased God, that God thought it would be really better for God to choose him. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that when it pleased God, he chose him in his womb and still let him go off and be super religious and to allow him to be murderous of his children. It must have pleased God no end. And when you read that he says, I annihilated the chosen of God, the children of God. And then you said that that it pleased God to choose him from the womb before he did any of these things. If you think that that's a sane connection, if you think that's a sane transition, then I suspect that you are religious to a fault, that you've lost the ability to exercise good judgment, because that's an insane transition. That makes God look like he is sadistic. Yeah, I think it would please me to find somebody who wants to annihilate and is engaged in annihilating my children on religious grounds. That's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to choose that person to reveal my son. And oh, by the way, this notion that I'm going to have disciples that are going to live with me for 3 years so that they can communicate to the world that I fulfilled and honored my promises relative to the Moed Mikre, and then can do so immediately, forget about all that. No, I, right from the womb, unlike the fishermen that I picked and the tax collectors that I picked to experience 3 years of my life, I'm going to pick this idiot from the womb. And not going to meet with him, not going to teach him, not going to allow him to witness anything I have to say or do. And we're going to pretend like that's immediate, even though it's some 20 years later. Yep. And then we're going to have this idiot who just told you that he was a really good student of the traditions of his forefathers, and that he was the best student of Gamaliel, the number one rabbinical teacher of the time, say, you know, I didn't learn anything from flesh and blood, contradicting what he had just said. That's where we are. Now, you think that's divinely inspired scripture? Congratulations. Here's your sign. You are a religious idiot. You are like those evangelical Christians that are going to vote for the Republicans. You've been fooled not only by politics, but by your religion. You've been played for a fool. And it's your fault. This is not hard to figure out. Now, as we return our attention to a more modern swamp, we find that the King James Version continues to render evangelizo, which means either beneficial message or a healing messenger, inconsistently, preferring gospel unless the context precludes the use of this inaccurate designation. Further, their inclination to translate ethnos based upon the English word ethnic and ethnicity as hearken on some occasions and as Gentiles on others is both incriminating and it's unprofessional. Moreover, there's no basis for the title God in the Greek text of this passage. This known, the King James reads, "But when it pleased God, who separated me from my mother's womb," and I guess God was his wet nurse, "and called me by his grace," although God doesn't have any graces, "to reveal his son in me," So that Paul becomes the manifestation of the Son. You see, Paul doesn't want to represent the Messiah. He wants to be the Savior. I might preach him among the heathen. Immediately I confer not with flesh and blood. So here, he's not preaching him to the heathen immediately, but instead immediately not conferring with flesh and blood. No. Immediately not conferring with flesh and blood makes no sense. And by the way, Son in me is preposterous. And preach him among the heathen is a really horrible translation, not even a translation, but corruption of ethnos. And preach him as opposed to as a translation of euangelizo is absurd. Now, since grace cannot be found in the original Greek manuscripts, the King James must have picked it up from elsewhere, the Vulgate, perhaps. Jerome wrote, "But when it pleased him who, from my mother's womb, had set me apart, and who had called me by his gratium, to reveal his Son within me, so that I might euangelizium him among the gentubus, I did not next seek the consult or consent of flesh and blood." So here we have the King James obviously being a translation of the Latin Vulgate and conveying words that are not in the Greek text, but are found in the Latin rendition. Now, should God have set Shaul apart right out of the womb to conduct his mission, then God would have had to have been with him when he was a sexual pervert and when he was an assassin. God would have had to have been at his side when he was religious and when he was denouncing his religion. And he would have to be there when Paul said, you know, I'm insane. He would have to have been there when Paul said, I'm demon-possessed. And that would make Paul's God every bit as schizophrenic as his wannabe apostle. The translation, which isn't living nor a translation, was obviously infatuated with grace. That's evangelical Christianity has got a thing for the cute little girls, pagan as they may be. It not only adds its alluring religious charm without any textual support, but calls the grace marvelous. The idea of being set apart was evidently lost on these theologians who did not translate ecclesia accurately either. So here's the New Living Translation, their novelized account to pretty up Paul's words to make him appear sound, sensible. It says, "But even before I was born, God chose me and called me by his marvelous grace. Then it pleased him to reveal his Son to me so that I would proclaim the good news about Jesus to the Gentiles. When this happened, I did not rush out to consult with any human being." Every bit of that is a lie. God did not choose him before he was born. God does not choose anyone before they were born. God does not have grace, much less marvelous grace. God does not call us to grace. God calls us to the Torah. He invites us to his covenant. He invites us to his Moed Mikra. It does, the Greek does not say, it pleased him to reveal his Son to me. Paul writes that the Son was revealed in him. And there is this idea, I would proclaim the good news, is not an accurate rendering of euangelizo. It is better than the change to gospel. But There is no proclaim in the word. Now, Jesus was not mentioned, and while ethnos can be translated Gentiles, because he was meaning it as ethnicities and therefore non-Jewish, this idea that he did not rush out to consult with any human being is not what Paul wrote. So how does a book that claims to be the inerrant word of God differ so radically from what the authors actually wrote, and no one seems to care? Now, we do not have a copy of the report that Shaul received from the Galatians, but it was obvious from his response that they were, at the very least, highly suspect of Paul's credentials and his preaching. This is Galatians 1:17. I did not ascend into Jerusalem toward the goal of being with or against pros the apostles, the messengers who are sent out from Apo, sent out and Stelo to be prepared and equipped before me. But to the contrary, I went away, withdrawing to Arabia and returned again to Damascus. Now, there's a problem with this. One of the problems, of course, is that there is Paul in this letter will give his timeline. And also Paul, in the historian account by Luke in Acts, his attaché, has a timeline of what occurred after his encounter with Satan on the road to Damascus. And the first thing that happens, according to these accounts, is that he consulted with a fellow who took him into his house so that he could recover from the horrible experience with the flashing light. But yet he says, I didn't meet or consult with flesh and blood. I didn't consult with a human being. But yet in every account, he says he did. And in the account as it is presented in Acts, as where we will consider in a moment, does not allow, nor even the account that he presents in Galatians, nor does the timeline, particularly with this letter and the Jerusalem summit, none of them mesh with him spending 3 years in Arabia. He not only does not allow, there's no time for a three-year sojourn to Arabia within the storyline of Paul's missions. There is no mention of anything that was said there. There is no mention of where, how he got there, or who he met with there, or what he was taught there, or how he got back, or anything. Nothing. And as a matter of fact, if you want to go to Arabia to meet with God, Mount Horeb is in Arabia. What God's going to disclose to you in Arabia is the same thing he disclosed on Mount Horeb 3,400 years ago. Historical. So that you know, Papyrus 46 uses Elphon in the first clause, not Anerkomai, as is suggested by modern compiled manuscripts. So less accurate and verbose, perhaps, than Nestle Almond interlinear, not correcting for the oldest witness, therefore in wholesale discord with its own purpose. Reads, but I went up to Jerusalem toward the before me delegates, but I went off to Arabia, and again I returned to Damascus. Now, nothing would have been more compelling, more reassuring with regard to Shaul's credibility than a trip to Arabia. It would have put Paul in the same conversation with Moshe. Just as the Torah was revealed to Moshe and the children of Israel on Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb in Arabia, the affirmations regarding its teaching and guidance would have been revealed to Shaul for the benefit of the rest of the world. Only it didn't happen. But beyond that, if I want to go to Mount Horeb, if I want to visit with Yahweh in Arabia, all I have to do is read the Torah. I don't have to get on an airplane. Matter of fact, there'd be no advantage of me going to Mount Horeb, but you can find it. It's easy if you use Google Earth. There's a chain link fence around the site now that was built by the Saudi Arabians with watchtowers all over it, so it's difficult to access it. But you can see the charred top of the mountain where Yahweh's light was manifest. You can see the rock that cracked and gushed forth in water, and you can see actually the places where the water streamed out of the rock. You can see the altar that the children of Israel made for the Egyptian sun god in the form of the golden calf or bull. It's you can even see where hundreds of thousands of people trampled down the desert en route to the basis of this area around Mount Horeb. It's all visible. You can even see the Nuweiba beach crossing on the Gulf of Aqaba as the children of Israel managed to escape the oncoming Egyptian army and the land bridge that exists from Nuweiba Beach into Saudi Arabia. It's all there. But while the scenery, I'm sure, is stark and maybe even inspiring, and it might be interesting to stand in the same place that Yahweh revealed the Torah and presented his children with this wonderful gift, the fact is that the Torah exists to teach. And so if I want to experience God's teaching, I just need to open the Torah and read it. There is nothing that I can gain by going to Arabia. There is nothing that Paul could have gained by going to Arabia. The whole idea is ludicrous. God's teaching is contained in the Torah. He says, don't subtract from it, don't add to it. He says the Torah is eternal. It is his everlasting teaching. Even Torah means to teach. Based on the Hebrew word, Hebrew verb, yara, to teach, to instruct, to guide. And so all Paul had to do to get the full benefit of God's teaching in Arabia is just to open the Torah and read it. Going to Arabia would have been an absolute and utter waste of time. But a private meeting with the God that he was unwilling to meet with when he was in Jerusalem is all about Paul. You see, Paul had to be special. The rest of the world met with the human manifestation of God in Jerusalem. Not Paul. The rest of the world benefits from meeting God through his Torah as revealed through Moshe to the children of Israel and Arabia. No, not Paul. He had to have his own special revelation. Anytime somebody tells me they got a special revelation from God, I immediately turn a deaf ear. It's just not true. And almost always when somebody claims to have a personal revelation from God, as Paul is claiming here, that revelation is in conflict with what God told the rest of us. And so that makes God schizophrenic. It makes God someone who contradicts himself, which means that someone who cannot be trusted. And that's precisely what happened with Paul. So this trip makes no sense. It is ridiculous, and it did not happen. The first of five compelling reasons to discount the Arabian sojourn is that Paul's Galatians testimony cannot be reconciled with his own account in Acts 9, the ninth chapter, which was written a decade later. In his testimony to Luke, Paul's portrayal of events following his experience on the road to Damascus does not include a trip to Arabia. In the historical account as it's presented in Acts, he claims that his public mission began within days of his spiritual encounter. And since the book of Acts is a far better attested and vastly more detailed account of Paul's mission, his life, logic compels us to favor the historian's authenticated chronology over Galatians, which is wholly uncorroborated, especially when they're in conflict, as they are here. In this regard, in the immediate aftermath of his so-called conversion experience, Paul told Luke, the Greek historian who compiled Acts, that he was specifically instructed to spend time with an especially timid man named Ananias, an individual known to history, unknown to history, apart from Paul's telling of events. So Ananias, unknown, apart from Paul's testimony to his attaché, the historian Luke. And according to Paul, in Acts, he went directly to meet with Ananias, who would be flesh and blood. And while we will consider Paul's recollection of this meeting in a moment, the newly minted apostle told Luke that after spending a few days recovering in the home of his reluctant benefactor from the trauma, and it was a terrible trauma inflicted by the harassing spirit who besieged him on the road to Damascus, very much like Muhammad's experience with the spirit that besieged him in the cave outside of Mecca, he immediately began preaching in Damascus. We read, "He took some food and regained his strength. Now, for several days, he was with the disciples who were at Damascus, and immediately he began to proclaim Yahusha in the synagogues, saying that he is the Son of God." Acts 9, 19 and 20. Now, there is a considerable difference between spending a few days in the home of a Damascus resident, regaining strength, and a long sojourn across an enormous swath of desert into Arabia. As such, Paul either lied to Luke or to the Galatians. Beyond the discrepancy in time, if we are to believe that Shaul met with the healing messenger as he has so often attested, why did such an encounter weaken him? You know, my experience with God is that he empowers me. I've never experienced any encounter with Yahweh where I was weakened. In fact, it would be counterproductive. It would be an abject discord with the benefits of the covenant, where he says to his children, "I will enrich and empower you." That's what fathers do. This says that Paul was with the disciples, which means that either he was meeting with two or more of the 11 surviving men who had walked alongside Yahusha, who just happened to be in Damascus, and were so irrelevant to Paul's story that they went unnamed, or Paul was lying once more. Moreover, recognizing that they are one and the same, in Galatians, Paul specifically stated that he initially avoided all contact with the apostles. Paul is lying. It's obvious. There is no way to reconcile this testimony. It's the problem with lying, is you forget what you said. Paul evidently dashed off this letter to the Galatians, trying to shore up his tattered credentials because they had turned on him, trying to proclaim himself the big shot. And he made a bunch of claims that just weren't true. And then when he was talking to Luke, he couldn't weave those same lies into the chronology. So his hope was that no one would make the connection between the two. But that's what we're supposed to do. If we want to question whether or not somebody's telling us the truth, it is by examining their testimony and seeing if their testimony is contradictory or consistent. In Paul's case, it is wholly and completely contradictory. He was absolutely lying both times. Also in direct conflict with Galatians, this time the chronology, the next line in Acts reads, And all of those who heard him continued to be amazed, and they said, is he not the one who in Jerusalem destroyed those who called on this name and who had come here for the purpose of bringing them bound before the chief priests? Well, annihilating people, as we were told Paul had done, is very different than bringing them to trial. Also, since the Romans at this time were mostly ambivalent to a person's perspective on God, inside the Roman province of Yehuda of Judea, the chief priests would have had no jurisdictions in such matter. Not in Jerusalem, and most especially not in Galatia. This scenario is not only unattested in history, it is incongruous with the historical evidence of the period. But Paul would have us believe. And then Shaul kept increasing in power, confounding the Jews who live in Damascus, Acts 9:22. Sure sounds like the same arrogant fellow we've been reading about in Galatians. All that mattered was that the world come to see Paul as great. Paul wanted to have the world see Jews, of which he was, as a lesser life form, because, you know, it's pretty obvious that, Paul wanted to claim credibility for having studied at Gamaliel's feet, the foremost rabbinic scholar of the time, someone that Yosha despised, and whom Yosha would say, rather than giving you credibility, would usurp credibility from you, that Paul failed in rabbinic school. This whole idea that the rabbis chose Paul to be an assassin, to be a kidnapper, to be a tyrant, it's not credible. And then for Paul to speak this hostily, this negatively, this critically, this erroneously about Judaism, while claiming to be a great Jewish student, is the same genre here as Paul claiming to speak for God while criticizing his Torah. I mean, Paul says that he was the best Jewish student, and then he goes out of his way to rebuke Judaism. It's just like God says, I was chosen by God right in the womb to be his special messenger. And next words out of his mouth demean what God actually said. So his relationship with Judaism is identical to his relationship with God. Both he claims to be the special messenger, and both he demeans their core message. Now, I suspect that the reason for this is twofold. With Judaism, I'm quite convinced that rabbinic Jews saw Paul as for who he was, as ruthless, as vicious, as sexually perverted. I mean, Paul admits that he's sexually perverted. He admits that he was brutal and murderous and ruthless. And those traits did not endear him to rabbinic Jews. And so the Pharisees kicked him out, said, go away. And so he came to hate them. He says, I'll get you. And on the road to Damascus, the spirit that beat him up so that he had to recover was Satan. And Satan's got a bone to pick with God. And so here is Paul. He's opposed to rabbinic Judaism, and he's opposed to Paul for different reasons. But it's the same animosity, the same dichotomy. It's the same internal contradiction between his claiming to represent God and then besmirching the Torah, and claiming to be a great religious Jew and then demeaning religious Jews. It's amazing that Christians don't see that. Well, it's obvious that Paul wanted the world to see Jews as a lesser life form. After all, just as the rabbis had been with Muhammad, Torah observant Jews knew that he was lying. That's the reason that Muhammad lashed out and murdered Jews in Yathrib, today's Medina, is they knew that he was lying because they were familiar with the Talmud and with the Torah. And so they know, God, you're an idiot. And anybody that was conversant, that was aware of the Torah, anyone even today who's aware of the Torah, knows that Paul is lying. And so Paul went to war against those who knew that he was lying. This is Acts 9:23-26. And when many days had elapsed, the Jews plotted together to do away with him. But their plot became known to Shaul. And they were also watching the gates day and night so they might put him to death. But his disciples took him by night, and they let him down through the wall, lowering him in a basket. And when he came to Jerusalem, he was trying to associate with the disciples, but they were afraid of him. This reads just like the Quran. It's like all of the early surahs in the Quran. The Meccans are shown scheming against Muhammad, only to have Allah alert his apostle and foil the plot. Of course, the stories are never true, mind you, and that Muhammad was little more than a whiny nuisance. But the same could be said for Paul in Damascus. It's for darn sure none of this occurred. It's Paul just as a whiny nuisance trying to establish Jews as his adversary, Jews as murderous, and him as the recipient of God's warning. It's all a lie.